From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are in the last week of 2023, and when we take a listen back, we had more than 500 conversations on Insight. And it's become a tradition this time of year to reflect and take stock of all we learned and experienced, thanks to our guests, who are thoughtful and often vulnerable. Today's show is a great example of what makes Insight so special. This year, we were lucky to have not one, but two Sacramento-based Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonists, each with remarkable and thought-provoking careers. To start us off, we're going to revisit my conversation with Jack Oman, the longtime editorial cartoonist for the Sacramento Bee. That's where Jack earned his Pulitzer, but his career started more than 40 years ago when, at 19 years old, he became a nationally syndicated editorial cartoonist. I sat down with Jack back in July as he closed a bittersweet chapter with the Sac Bee. Jack, thank you so much for making the trip here to the Insight Studio.
Great to see you.
You know, when taking in your career, there is a lot to talk about and to unpack. But I think the best way to start is kind of like the origin story. Where did your interest and your passion for editorial cartoons, when did it begin?
Well, I have to say, I think I came to this naturally in the sense that I was born in 1960. My mother and father were actually named John and Jackie. They named me Jack, and they voted for Nixon. So, you know, I was born to be an ironist. So my father worked for the U.S. Forest Service, and we moved to Washington, D.C. in March of 1968. And so some of your listeners may remember March of 1968. And so I was exposed to some national events as a child. I went to Robert F. Kennedy's burial at Arlington. I saw President Johnson and Jackie Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy in the hearse pulled right in front of me, and I remember the hyper-illuminated American flag. I watched Washington burning after King was assassinated. And then the huge anti-war marches in D.C. when I was a kid. And so that really got me interested in public affairs and politics. And then Watergate happened. And then I was obsessed with Watergate. And I was the guy in class who followed Watergate instead of the Minnesota Twins. And then I was also the compulsive doodler who messed up all my social studies papers with little drawings of Nixon and Gerry Ford and people of that era. And so ultimately I wound up going into politics, and I was an advance man for a congressional candidate in 1978 and worked as an advance man for Vice President Mondale at 17 when I was an intern at the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party office. And so then there was one of my friend's mothers was a dean at the University of Minnesota, and she said, oh, look, there's an opening for a political cartoonist at the Minnesota Daily. And so I applied for that and wound up getting it because they had 39 art students and me. And the trick question for everybody was, who is William F. Buckley? And so, of course, I watched Firing Line every week, and I've read him. And I watched all this stuff and read all this stuff. And so I wound up getting the job. And then when I was in college, I got syndicated at age 19, and I was the youngest syndicated cartoonist in the United States. By the time I was 20, I was the second most widely read cartoonist in the United States in 392 newspapers and on the Columbus Dispatch. And my face hadn't cleared up yet.
Would someone call you at that time? I mean, that is impressive at just being a teenager, 19 years old. But did someone at that time call you an old soul? Because I think there's like a lot of wisdom that has to come into editorial cartoons and just editorials in general.
Well, I am now at 62.95. Sure. I mean, I was very composed. I was very unusually composed because I wanted to go into politics. And I was kind of the kid on the debate team and the captain of the Quiz Bowl team on TV. Yes, we came in third out of 32 teams in Minnesota. And, you know, wore the tie, you know, everybody knows that guy with the news anchor hair. And so, sure, I was like a little Walter Cronkite.
You clearly had an interest, obviously, in public affairs, in politics, being engaged with what's going on in the world, and having a front row seat to it, especially during the 60s and the 70s. But that could have taken you along different trajectories. I mean, you dipped your toe into politics a little bit. You could have dipped your toe into like reporting, but you chose editorial cartoons and you really built that momentum over the decades. Where do you think editorial cartoons fit within journalism and within politics?
Well, I still think they're hugely important. And people actually read editorial cartoons and like editorial cartoons. It is a indigenous species to American journalism, and there are very few of us anyway. And so the role of the American editorial cartoon has been huge going back to the founding of the country and in France and in England in the 1700s. And so this is a 300-400-year tradition of caricature. I mean, Da Vinci was doing caricatures. He called them grotesques. And so people love grotesques. And so consequently, I think that it's still hugely valuable. And I would not have chosen any other career path. I mean, my original thinking was, well, if I can't become a U.S. senator from Minnesota, I'll become a political cartoonist. Like, it looked easy to me in 10th grade. And the fact is it's incredibly difficult to do properly. And so I thought, well, I wound up becoming a political cartoonist because I wasn't really seeing the House seat I could run for in some ways, you know?
What goes into your creative process? Because, you know, some of your cartoons can seem so simplistic, but there's a lot of nuance and thoughtfulness that goes behind it.
I use the word reductionist, not simplistic, right? It's distillation. And so that's the key. What people really don't understand about this job is it's not an art job, it's a writing job. And so one of my friends once said that editorial cartooning were editorial cartoons in haiku form. And so that's the way I see it, where you are trying to, I mean, I consider myself primarily a writer, actually, with a, you know, art talent as a side hustle. And so I do enjoy drawing and I'm, you know, good at what I do in that regard. But I also don't think about it as like, oh, I'm going to draw an elephant and a donkey today. I'm thinking about what's that little turn of phrase, that little three-word thing, you know, that gets you to the actual idea. That's the job.
With all of the arguably noise that goes on with politics and the constant continuous coverage, how do you narrow in on a topic or an issue when creating a cartoon?
Well, Senator Howard Baker once said, what did the president know and when did they know it? I'm always trying to judge what do the readers know and when do they know it. And so there's so many different things that I read every day. And, you know, back in the day when I started in 1978, you got the daily newspaper and, you know, maybe you read The Times and you listened to Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings and that, you know, Huntley Brinkley. Sorry, that's old. And then that's how you got information. And now it's like you don't even know what you're reading. It's just online, you know, and that's part of the problem. But like if you're discerning, you know what you're reading. You know that you're reading The New Republic or The Atlantic or, whatever it is. So that's a major element of my preparation.
There's obviously a point of view with an editorial cartoon. But when thinking of the reader, do you ever take into account the opinions and the reaction that your work might elicit? Or does that just become too much of a distraction in the creative process?
I don't think about it. I think about what I think about and whether I'm expressing myself articulately and properly. And what everybody else thinks is up to them. I don't cater to anybody. I do what I believe in.
You know, you mentioned that obviously the way that we consume news, it is constantly evolving. The only constant is change, especially, you know, in journalism and news. When people are scrolling, you know, like on a social media app or they're scrolling on their laptop or their desktop, how has that impacted editorial cartoons and the way that you reach people across many different mediums?
Well, I can tell you that my work led the newsroom in terms of page views, generally speaking. So there's a digital audience out there. But there's so many different ways to do it now. I mean, you have to sometimes, if you were thinking about, okay, I've got to do it on a phone, you know it's going to scroll. It's got to be a certain simplicity and a certain sequencing. And so that's important. I've also done videos, and videos really work well on the phones. And so I've adapted over decades.
In your time creating these cartoons, I mean, did you have to develop a tougher skin if someone didn't like it? Has anything ever stung a little bit when someone reacted to a cartoon?
You get over it really fast. And sure, the worst thing you could say to me was, I didn't draw well. I mean, that was, oh, you're not a very good illustrator. You know, that's like the artist part. But the rest of it, I don't have time to care, number one. Number two, I've certainly been in situations over the course of my career where I was very concerned about my safety, honestly, and even here. And in the Trump era, the people are really good now at threatening you online and just staying on this side of the line of, you know, legally actionable. And so, of course, I'm concerned.
On the flip side, Governor Jerry Brown was a popular and his dog Sutter as well was a popular subject. Has anyone who's been the subject of your editorial cartoons, you know, built a rapport with you and reached out to you?
Of course. Politicians really like seeing themselves in cartoons, generally speaking. I was just up at Governor Brown's ranch as his guest and doing an interview with him. He's absolutely delightful in person and completely different than what I had thought. I mean, I had met him a few times, and the first time I saw him was in 1978 as a 17-year-old at Hubert Humphrey's funeral with his father, Governor Pat Brown. And then I saw him in 1992 when he was running for president with Jacques Bergazzi in the Park Blocks in Portland, Oregon, wearing the silk jacket and so on. And then coming out here, I've been drawing cartoons about Jerry Brown since I was 14 years old. And so to actually spend a couple hours with him was stunning to me. And he's very kind of funny, like dry, kind of jokey, that stunned me. I've never seen this from him before. And when I went up there, I did a video with him in an interview where I minored in classics and he majored in classics. And so we were doing Latin conjugations together.
I know it. He and his Latin.
Quid novi puer. That's what's up, kid. And then Governor Newsom, I have a delightful relationship, frankly. People probably don't know this, but he's one of the best impressionists I've ever run into.
Really?
Like, he's very good at doing Clinton and Schwarzenegger and people like that. And he's an absolute delight in person. And he's very charismatic in a way that people don't get until you get in the room with him. Well, they get it. But I mean, he's even more charismatic in person. And so, yes, I have policy differences with him, and I have policy differences with Governor Brown, and I've hip-checked them many, many times, but they know what the deal is. It's commentary. It's very important in this society to have free commentary and free opinion.
Yeah. And when it comes with this type of commentary, it, of course, can broach uncomfortable topics, difficult topics. It elicits a reaction that's important, rapport, debate, you know, for people to talk about it. But you also touch upon emotional and tragic moments as well. One of the cartoons that you created was the Challenger mission back in 1986. And the cartoon, you essentially took, you know, seven stars from the U.S. flag and used it as a silhouette for the Challenger space shuttle. And you not only did that, but you sold the cartoon and you donated those proceeds to the families of the seven crew members that were killed. Just taking it in as a reader, it's a very emotional piece of work. And I would imagine the process for you was emotional as well when thinking about it and creating it.
Well, having had a 43-year career, I think that's right, 45 actually, these national tragedies have come up, and these are not gag cartoons. You have to constantly shift gears as an editorial cartoonist to read the room, to meet the moment. And so I remember I was at a gas station in Portland, Oregon, and listening to the shuttle blow up on ABC radio. And I remember so clearly Vic Ratner saying, "Was that supposed to happen?" And then I went into the Oregonian and did that cartoon, and I had a 1 o'clock deadline, and I had no idea. And one of my friends who was a copy came in and he said, "Something with the flag." And he's now a number 4 New York Times bestselling author, actually. And then the 9/11, same thing, where you're like, I remember sitting just absolutely aghast and in shock and trying to comfort my children and having to go to work and draw something on this before 1:30. And so I did the same thing, and raise money. I think I raised $30,000-$40,000 for the United Way fund for 9/11. So I've done cartoons about presidential assassination attempts. I was just thinking about the Reagan attempt. I mean, things like that. You've got to stay focused and relevant and tasteful. And you want to be able to have people look at that and say, this is the emotion that I'm feeling. And when you're doing just a ham and eggs political cartoon, you just lay in your opinion out there and take it or leave it, baby.
The humanity behind an editorial cartoon in those moments.
Well, I try to be human, you know.
Well, you do a pretty good job at it.
Well, thank you so far. But the notion that I can abdicate my responsibility as a commentator and check my opinions at the door, that ain't happening. I do what I feel every day. That is my genuine emotion and my genuine position.
Who taught you that? Was it your parents or other family members, a mentor when you were young?
No. My father was the Norwegian great Santini. He was a Bronze Star winning PhD. And I would say emotional expression in Minnesota, Norwegian, Swedish homes is not really A1.
Didn't emote well.
He didn't emote well. My mother was emotive in a different way. So I think I was raised in a family where, you know, feelings weren't expressed very often. And if they were expressed loudly. And so I kind of came out of that as a super empath almost. And everybody who knows me is like, you know, Jack reaches out, Jack cares about me, Jack likes me, and people like me, you know. And you would look at me and you think, well, this guy works at the weed shop, you know, or the fly shop, you know. I mean, I got 21-inch long white hair, you know. And then, but I care about people. And that's why I was attracted to politics, is I loved meeting people and I loved registering voters and I loved telling people about my candidates. And I love public speaking. And obviously, I can run my mouth occasionally. And so, I mean, it's important for me to be able to convey my emotions and to click with people. You know, I'm not some recluse sitting in the corner drawing cartoons.
I can completely relate to your path of becoming an empath that started within your household with your parents. Mm-hmm. I can definitely relate to that. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist Jack Oman, who was with the Sacramento Bee. Jack, we're talking to you under circumstances where you're no longer with the Sacramento Bee. You and other three award-winning cartoonists were let go by McClatchy, and that's the parent company of the Sacramento Bee, after a decade of really remarkable work. What can you share with us regarding the departure of you and your colleagues, or what would you like to share?
I will only share my emotions. I feel betrayed. I feel slapped in the face. I felt like I had been T-boned at an intersection. That's all I have to say. Other than I love my colleagues at the Sacramento Bee. They're wonderful people. They're trying to do their job under very difficult circumstances.
Given that you were with the Sacramento Bee for almost 10 years, or roughly a decade, from 2013 until just July of this year, in what ways has editorial cartooning changed or evolved over that time?
Over 10 years? It's interesting. When I went to that newspaper, their circulation was 199,000. I can tell you it's way less than that, right? It's a public record. It's a fact. Everybody's like that all across the country. The fact is that cartoons are still relevant and important, and they're an important feature of any daily newspaper. And so I don't really want to get into specifics about anything regarding my former employer. But I will say that I still think cartoons are interesting to people.
Yeah, and people find them interesting. I mean, you said yourself that even though the landscape is changing to more digital and social media, I mean, people are still going to take in your work, and not only your work, but the work of other editorial cartoonists.
Well, I remain in syndication with Tribune Content Agency and 200 newspapers, and I can assure you that you'll be hearing where I'm going and what I'm doing very, very soon.
Yeah, I would imagine that you are in high demand. You know, you've won so many awards over the years, but I would think one of the biggest ones was the Pulitzer Prize in 2016. What did that mean to you?
When you win the Pulitzer, you become the Pulitzer brand. And even my golf partners are like, that wasn't a Pulitzer Prize winning putt, you know, or that was a lousy Pulitzer winning drive. This is our Uncle Billy who we play with. And there is this element of, I remember so clearly right after I won and we were golfing, and I play at Land Park a lot and for $19 a round, and this guy came up to me and said, Mr. Oman. And I said, yes. And he said, I just wanted to congratulate you on your Nobel Prize. And I said, thanks, it was for physics. And, you know, but it's Nobel is Pulitzer, is MacArthur, whatever. But you are a captive of that brand. The other one that was really interesting to me was the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award, where I got a phone call from Ethel Kennedy.
Wow.
And I said, Mrs. Kennedy, I want to tell you how important your husband was to me. And she said, you honor Bobby's memory with your work. And I said, I wanted to tell you that I went to the burial at Arlington. And that was like the most moving moment of my career. And she said, oh, that means so much to me. And people like you are carrying on Bobby's work by just remembering him and thinking about him when you do your stuff. Those are the two biggest moments for me in winning these awards. And I mean, awards are cool. And sometimes you actually get money from the awards. And but to me, that I obviously got incredibly emotional thinking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a full circle moment, because you were at the forefront at your time as a youth of taking in these really historical moments in U.S. history. And then in the past decade, we have had our share of history making moments as well. When you kind of bookend both of them, how has politics and media coverage changed during these historic moments from, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago to now?
Well, I came of age during Watergate, and really, that is very comparable right down to the Trump era. Roger Stone was operating back then, and Roger Stone is operating now, and that's 50 years ago. And so we can all look back and think about Camelot and think about the New Frontier and the Great Society and all the things and civil rights movement and all that. Yeah, we've moved the ball in a lot of ways. But there hasn't been a lot of change in some ways. We reverted badly under Trump and this culture. And he just kind of exposed what a lot of Americans are. He didn't invent it. He just publicized it. I will say that just, one of the my favorite movies is The Candidate. And it came out in 1972. And it's about a U.S. Senate candidate played by Robert Redford. You know, they didn't have digital. They didn't have anything. They had just TV and filmed spots and, you know, interviews with newspapers. And now, like, that's almost gone almost. It's completely atomized. It's just different on every level, to the point where politicians, in some ways, you know, they almost don't work individual institutions because they're just tweeting their own things out and, you know, doing their things on Instagram and so on. And it's very difficult to get a coherent message out. I mean, there's a U.S. Senate race going on right now in California with three of the probably most effective members of Congress. Nobody's talking about it yet. I mean, you don't hear anybody talking about this Senate race. I find that really curious. And so back in the day, you know, it was all elephants and donkeys and waving flags and may the best person win and so on. And now it's like, I'm going to destroy you. You're a pedophile. You're, you know, whatever it is. It's like the debate has gotten ratcheted up to the point where a normal person, which most people are, frankly, are sick of it. And rightly so.
And given how things are evolving, that still gives you and other editorial cartoonists a lot of material to work with thoughtfully. You know, I know that you're working on your future plans. I imagine and hope that we will continue to see more of your cartoons again soon. But a little bit of a curveball, you're also an author and you have written many books on fishing.
Yes.
Can we expect another one at some point? I think one was called Inconvenient Trout.
Yes.
I love that.
Angler Management. They're fly fishing books, the four. I am working on this. I can talk about. I was recruited by Writer's House Literary Agency to create a graphic memoir on the moon landing. And so I'm very interested in that. And so I'm way down the road on that proposal. And I've been working on that for 9 months. So I will be focusing some time on that in the, going forward. But I can assure you that I have lots of things going on that I can't talk about right now.
I love that, Jack. I'm happy that you're busy. It is very, very well deserved. Thank you for taking the time.
You're a delight. Thank you.
That is Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Jack Gohman discussing his incredible career and an end of an era at the Sacramento Bee. Our conversation first aired in July, and Jack has since moved over to the San Francisco Chronicle as a contributing columnist. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a listen back to some of the best conversations this year, and this show is diving into the careers of two Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonists who call Sacramento home. Darren Bell is the first Black editorial cartoonist to ever receive the award, and his latest work turns inward with a graphic memoir. Growing up in Los Angeles in the 80s and 90s to a white mother and Black father, through vulnerable illustrations, Darren examined his life, sharing the intimate experiences that shaped his understanding of race and racism. It all came full circle when, as a father, he must decide whether he's ready to have the talk with his own son. Darren Bell joined us back in September about his graphic novel, The Talk. Thanks for making the time, Darren.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
You reference points in your book that you write about that are reference points for myself, too. I'm from Los Angeles. I went to LAUSD. I'm from Northeast LA. I also went to UC Berkeley as well. But unlike me, I didn't have a ton of direction. You were so focused, and you really had a drive at a young age that centered around creativity, around drawing, around cartoons. Your career as a staff cartoonist began at 20 years old while in college. When did drawing and creating illustrations, when did it start for you?
Well, I actually show where it starts in the book. It started with my need to express something that I couldn't actually say that an incident happens. I have a bad run-in with the police at the age of six, which I, you know, as a six-year-old thought that I brought it on myself. And I went home and I just couldn't tell my mom about it. So I just drew and drew and drew until I got it out.
Yeah, I mean, as children, we don't always have the right words or even the emotional vocabulary to really understand a world that we're still learning about, right? It's kind of like a blank canvas. With creativity and drawing, I mean, these are outlets to cope and express ourselves, and healthy ones at that. How did it help you?
Well, it's basically art therapy. I think, you know, people are hardwired to respond to images and to express ourselves through images. I mean, it's why our GPSs have screens with maps. You know, it's why hieroglyphics came to be. It's why cave paintings still exist. For children, it's you know, whenever you ask them something that's too painful to relate in words, you know, you can hand them some crayons and a paper, and you know, they could express 1,000 words in one picture.
Yeah.
And you know, as a child, I think that's why I gravitated toward graphic novels and comic books. They're so much more powerful than I think people give them credit for.
And we learned that, or I learned that, when reading your graphic novel, a memoir. I mean, it's beautiful. When it comes to how you took art therapy as a child and you turned it into a career, it's a big part of your life. You have syndicated comic strips that have run for two decades. When did you begin to make the turn and begin dipping into politics with editorial cartoons?
Well, as a child, I mean, my father and I didn't have the closest relationship, but one thing that we shared was political satire. We used to read the LA Herald Examiner and the LA Times, and we'd read the cartoons together. You know, we used to watch All in the Family at night. So I always knew, and my father, I would see him open up and laugh, you know, while we were watching this, and I always knew that was something that I wanted to do when I grew up, and I wanted to talk about important things in a way that would make people laugh.
Did you always know that you would end up writing or creating a graphic memoir, turning inward?
I did not.
When did that start?
I thought I was gonna draw entirely metaphorical stories about superheroes, because I grew up reading the X-Men, And that was one long allegory about racism and discrimination. And it was really helpful that I was also, you know, I could turn that off whenever I felt like it and escape into, you know, their costumes and the stories. And I thought that's what I was going to do. But I found that I was more suited to telling stories four panels at a time as in comic strips, like Bloom County and Doonesbury. So I began doing that in high school for my high school paper once I became editor-in-chief. And, you know, one day we had a hole to fill, so I drew a political cartoon. And, you know, people responded really well to that. So I figured this is what I should be doing.
Hmm. Did you ever consider having a career in journalism? In the print, like you were the editor-in-chief of your school paper.
I did. That's what I wanted to do for a while. I wrote four or five columns and articles per issue for my high school paper, plus the staff editorial. And, you know, no one ever said a word about it to me. But when I drew that cartoon, everybody was talking about it. So it was like a light bulb going off. Yeah. I mean, I realized that it's still journalism. It's just graphic journalism.
There's certainly a message behind, you know, each poignant illustration that you put together.
Right.
The title of the book is called The Talk. It sounds like a simple title, but it centers on that conversation or that time that you briefly brought up when you were 6 years old. Your mom had a conversation with you about why you couldn't have a realistic water gun. I mean, she feared for your safety. You know, you kept the story to yourself for a long time. When did you decide that you wanted to share it?
I first shared it with a friend in grade school. And after I'd had a run-in with a security guard who, it's in the book, so I won't spoil it. But that friend responded by basically telling me that, you know, I must have imagined it, that, you know, my experience that I knew happened did not happen. That was maybe one of the first incidents of gaslighting that I experienced in my life. And it's something that I think most Black people and most minorities go through, you know, people thinking that they have the right to stand as an authority over your own experience, to decide whether they're going to validate it or not, to decide whether they're going to even believe it happened. So I kept it to myself after that until years later, when I gave an interview to the Washington Post about a series of cartoons I drew about Trayvon Martin, they asked me, they asked why I decided to do that, and all of a sudden this experience that I think I had actually suppressed ever since grade school came rushing back to me.
You know, when you talk about grade school or draw and write about it, it takes me back to school as a kid and being mixed race and not feeling like, you know, you fit in anywhere, you know, being told you're not really, at least in my case, you're not really Mexican, you're not really Asian, you're not really white. And I remember a part of your novel where a student called you half-African, you know, in high school. And sharing even the gaslighting among your friends who care about you and they like you, how did that influence your work?
Well, I think my work has revolved around just cutting through gaslighting. For the past 20 years, I've done that in my comic strip and my editorial cartoon. I call it how I see it, and you know, people write in and say no. You know, they gaslight you. They say how do you know what people have in their hearts? How can you tell that these incredibly racist comments you heard weren't just somebody misspeaking? I put it down in black and white on the page as not to convince gaslighters, but to comfort people who are going through that same thing. I want people to see my cartoons and think, wow, I somebody sees what's happening to me. And this stuff really is happening.
Your family plays such a big role in your book. What stands out to me is your mom, especially. There are many instances where, you know, your mom is white and she passionately defends you and your brother to a point where as a child, it embarrasses you or you're like, you're making it worse, like stop. But now you're a parent. How do you view all of that now?
Well, she was a superhero in retrospect. She did exactly what a great parent is supposed to do. She didn't care how embarrassing it might have been. She didn't care about you know, comforting the feelings or taking into account the feelings of somebody who had wronged her child. She just stood up for her child. And that's that, you know, to go back to what I said earlier, mm-hmm. That's what I do with my cartoons. I just say what I think is the truth. I don't really care about, you know, about the feelings of people who care more about their own feelings than they do about the point that I'm making. I mean, we have a whole state that's banning books, including The Talk, which was recently banned in part of Florida. I guess because they're concerned about the feelings of white children. And they're more concerned about their feelings than they are about the actual lived experiences mm-hmm. that black people go through.
Yeah, not wanting to have uncomfortable conversations to move forward, to progress.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have these conversations. It's ironic. The reason listed as for that school district, for that county banning the book is because it was age inappropriate. It's ironic because that's the point of the book. These things happening to little Darren in the book were age inappropriate. And they're being shared by millions. These experiences are shared by millions and millions of children. And children need to read about it. Grown-ups need to read about it.
Your mom had that conversation with you at a young age when you were 6 years old, and your mom talked about racism directly, whereas when it came to the men in your life, your brother, your father, your grandpa, they kind of talked around it or even avoided it or discounted it. And you kind of had to, from what I gathered from your work, interpret what they were saying as opposed to your mom just like giving it to you straight. How did you come to understand that dynamic as you got older and became a parent yourself?
Well, at first it was confusing because my mom, who was white, was the only one telling me these things, the only one telling me that the world was going to treat me differently than they would treat my white friends. The men in my life, my grandfather, my father, my brother, they chose not to talk about it, and I think it's because, they felt it too deeply. They had their own experiences, and they didn't want to influence the course of my life with their own experiences. They didn't want to infect me with their own trauma. And my mom didn't have to worry about that. She didn't have any personal trauma. To her, it was more academic. It was something that she witnessed in the civil rights era, something that she became passionate about, but not something that happened to her personally. I mean, she had her own struggles when she married a black man. And I mean, that's going to be the topic of my next book. But my brother, for instance, and my father taught me, when I tried to have the talk with him, he taught me to just laugh it off and not really think about it. My brother, when I tried to talk to him about these issues, insisted that the discrimination we were facing was not because of race, it was because we were poor. And I think the reason both of them did that is because it was some way of giving themselves agency. They had some control. My father thought, you know, it's totally in my power to laugh about something. And my brother thought, you know, it's totally in my power to not be poor. You know, I could work hard. I could get a great job, you know, and then, you know, someday the discrimination will stop.
It was something that they could control.
Right.
I thought about your mom during one moment. It was kind of, for me, a full circle moment. And that was when you were at Berkeley and it was your senior thesis. And a Berkeley professor accused you of plagiarism with no proof. And instead of cowering or being afraid, I mean, you calmly fight back. And what did that teach you? I thought of your mom in that moment.
Well, yeah, I didn't really consciously respond to her. I just, everything sort of synthesized in that moment. My mom, the way my mom would just stand up to teachers, the way my brother and my father had this desire to just assert control over what was happening in their life. So I opened my mouth and, you know, I won't spoil it because it's in the book, but all of these people came out of my mouth as when I opened it. And but what it showed me, I mean, up until then, I was buying into the whole respectability politics thing. I was thinking, well, you know, if I just excel in school, I'll be fine. And, you know, I was excelling in school.
Yeah, she didn't think you were capable of writing that caliber of a thesis paper, essentially.
Right. That's the thing. I was excelling a little bit too much for her. I mean, I was like average. I was doing average work probably for kids in that class. But it was a high caliber upper division class at UC Berkeley. And it just didn't seem to fit. When she read my essay, she didn't understand how it could be eloquent, you know, how it could be competent even. And that's, you know, that's when I realized that no matter how respectable you are, no matter how much you excel, eventually you're going to run into somebody who for the irrational reason of race is going to try to sabotage you. And you have to be prepared for that moment. And the best way to prepare to prepare for it is to have that talk when you're young, to know the signs to look for when you're talking to certain people, and to not be caught by surprise when it happens.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist Darren Bell about his graphic memoir, The Talk. The graphic memoir, I mean, I would not call it lighthearted. There are just feelings of frustration, of anger, there are a lot of painful moments and difficult moments. But there's also a tremendous amount of love and also humor. That's a tough balance to strike. How did you do it?
I think it's probably second nature. I've been drawing comic strips since 1995, and you know, I've dealt with really important issues, and I always, you know, have to somehow have a punchline. But the punchline for me is never a gag. The humor is found in the way characters humble themselves, or the universality of the experience is funny in itself. The humor just comes. I don't try for humor, you know, but when the humor is there, I reach out and grab it and put it on the page. And, you know, I did that throughout the talk. I mean, life isn't just bleak. And, you know, when you're faced with adversity and discrimination, you know, it's a horrible thing and it's traumatic, but it also gives you opportunities to find out who you are and, you know, to laugh at the craziness of the situation. You have to.
Given that your book, I think it spans like 40 years of your life. Mm-hmm. How was it like reflecting and filtering down your life into some of your most pivotal and poignant moments?
In a way it was cathartic and it was freeing, because I mean there was some emotional trauma that I carried from these experiences. You know, I spent my whole life trying to suppress them or to wish that they hadn't happened to me. But as I was writing this story, you know, I realized that, you know, things happen for a reason. But we tend to give them, we tend to imbue them with that reason, you know, the older we get. You know, we look back and we realize that our life is what it is because of what we went through and how we dealt with it. And there were certain things that happened to me as a kid that I always thought I brought on myself. But when I was writing the story and drawing the pictures, I realized, for instance, with the cop, this 6-foot-something cop standing, towering over a 6-year-old child, there was absolutely nothing about that that was that 6-year-old child's fault. And I don't think I truly realized that until I drew those images. So this doing the talk was the ultimate form of art therapy for me.
You call it the talk because it's a question that you have to face as a father, you know, with your own 6-year-old son who was asking about George Floyd. What advice do you have for adults or caretakers who don't really know how to begin difficult and uncomfortable conversations, but they're necessary to have?
Well, the first thing you should do is ask, ask how your child's day is going. Ask what they're learning. Ask if they're, you know, if they have any problems, if they're being bullied. And, you know, if the child's not going through anything traumatic, there's no reason to really have the talk yet. But as soon as the child experiences something like when I moved to Sacramento, my son was 3.5, almost 4, and we went to a playground at Oak Park, and a little white girl came and sat next to him, and you know they were getting along fine, but her father looked terrified, and he came and snatched her away. And you know my son wasn't old enough to really notice what happened, so I didn't have the talk with him yet. But a similar incident happened later on, and you know, and my child was old enough to ask about it, and that's when I, you know, realized he's old enough to hear about it.
Finally, Darren, how do you want readers to feel once they finish the book? And does that change depending on who you envision that reader to be?
Well, yeah, I want Black people who've gone through this and who are going through this to be comforted, to know that, you know, there's a way through it, and there's always hope, and the best way you could prepare your child for it. I mean, you can't keep this stuff from happening to your kid, but you can prepare them for it. You can just tell them that, you know, this is what's going to happen someday, and be prepared for it. Don't expect it, but when it happens, don't be surprised. And for white people, you know, the book is filled with countless microaggressions that I experienced in my life that millions of other people experienced too. And I think, you know, a lot of them happen because people, you know, well, people just haven't thought about it. But if they read this book, they might see, you know, some things that they tend to do, and they might stop. You know, they might be a bit introspective and think, have I been doing this to people? And, you know, that's the best way for people to grow. And, you know, I think, you know, growth is always good.
I second that. Thank you so much, Darren.
All right. Thank you.
It was a wonderful conversation.
That is Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Darren Bell talking about his latest work, a graphic memoir titled The Talk. You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.